Would you please continue on that?
Well, yeah, this is really crucially important, that the Communist Party, although in retrospect it doesn't seem to have been as powerful as it seemed, U.S. officials were really, really afraid of the Communist Party in Iran. And keep in mind, this was only a few years after Communist parties had taken over most of the countries in Eastern Europe, only a few years after the Soviet Union had tried to take over northwestern Iran. The Korean War was being fought at this time. So, you know, looking back 50 years ago, it may seem rather silly and trivial, but at the time, U.S. officials were deeply, deeply afraid that Iran might be taken over by the communists, and they felt that if there was any possibility of that, they had to do whatever they can to prevent it. So that was sort of the general background, and I think it's, you know, seems clear to me that the Republicans overemphasized that and saw very different concerns there than the Democrats did, but really on both sides, Americans were very concerned about that. Anyway, you know, as I said before, the crucial turning point came in the first month or two after Eisenhower was inaugurated in January 1953. In mid-March, U.S. officials gave the go-ahead to the CIA to begin the preparations. CIA then started assembling teams and appointing people to do key things. And they had their people in Tehran start, you know, looking around and making contact with people. They eventually made contact with a retired general named Fazlollah Zahedi, who had been plotting against Mossadegh in cooperation with the British for a pretty long time. And they soon decided that Zahedi was the one that they wanted to back to carry out the coup. And they started providing him money, probably in about April 1953, providing him with large amounts of money and providing money to various other people who could be helpful. They finally started putting together a concrete plan in May of 1953. As I mentioned before, Donald Wilbur, the Iran scholar at Princeton, was sent to Beirut to meet with one of the British intelligence agencies' leading experts on Iran, and the two of them, over the course of about 10 days, put together an outline for a plan for the coup. Basically, the plan that they came up with called for several steps. First of all, in the month or so leading up to the coup, the CIA would make an extensive effort to destabilize Mossadegh's government with propaganda activities, you know, putting anti-Mossadegh newspaper stories into newspapers and, you know, organizing disturbances in the streets and attacking mosques and doing things like that aimed at destabilizing Mossadegh's government and making Iranians, fearful and making them believe that Mossadegh was losing control over the situation. Then secondly, they were going to stage a disturbance, which would begin with a series of demonstrations organized by clerical figures, which the British had connections with. And those demonstrations, which would be held outside of the parliament, then would lead to a vote of no confidence in parliament to bring the Mossadegh government down. Now, this was all to be stage managed by the CIA, but it was what the plan called a quasi-legal coup effort, in the sense that, you know, CIA would take these various actions aimed at getting the parliament to vote no confidence in Mossadegh. Also, as part of that, they started spending a huge amount of money, $11,000 a week, to bribe members of parliament to do this. Now, at the time, there were only something like 80 members of parliament, and they probably had to bribe no more than half of them because others were either in one side or the other. So $11,000 a week divided by maybe 40 people that had to be bribed was just an absolutely fantastic amount of money at that time. So CIA started to bribe members of parliament. And so they hoped that that would work. An additional part of it was they planned to talk to the Shah, the king of Iran, and persuade him to support the parliament's efforts to vote no confidence in Mossadegh, and to get, you know, to give verbal support to that. And then finally, the last element of the plan was that if all this somehow didn't work out and this quasi-legal coup attempt did not occur, then they would just simply have this military team under ex-General Zahedi carry out a standard military coup. So anyway, that was the plan. It was developed in May of 1953. After these two figures drew up the plan, they went to London and Washington, ran the plan by British and American officials. A couple of subsequent versions were developed. You know, they refined certain elements of it. And by early June, they were ready to go. And so at that point, they already had teams assembled in Washington, in CIA headquarters. They started sending a few people out to Tehran to get started. The CIA station chief in Iran, from everything I was able to tell, was opposed to the coup, so they replaced him, and he actually left Tehran about 2 weeks before the coup occurred, and his successor, who was deeply involved in the coup, you know, took over at that point. By this time, they were pouring a lot of money into Iran to recruit people to participate in the coup. I guess the latter half of June, Kermit Roosevelt himself went secretly into Tehran under disguise and began to lead the operation from there. They also sent a CIA officer who had had a lot of experience with military stuff, what's called a paramilitary officer. He, together with an Iranian colonel who was a military attaché in Washington and was on the CIA payroll, they sent the two of them to Tehran to see what was happening with the military organization. They had given General Zahedi all this money to organize, you know, a network of military officers to lead a coup as a contingency plan. When they got there, they realized that Zahedi had done nothing, even though CIA had given him something like $135,000, which would be worth well over $1 million in today's money. He had done nothing with this, and he had no organization whatsoever. And so at that point, this CIA officer, his name was George Carroll, and the Iranian colonel, his name was Abbas Farzanagan, they basically organized a military network to carry out the coup. And that was in about the month or so before the coup finally occurred in mid-August. And so, you know, they began organizing their activities and, you know, feverishly working to get it together. At the same time, another key part of the original plan was to try to persuade the Shah to support the coup. They made a series of approaches to him. The U.S. ambassador, Loy Henderson, talked to him and tried to get him to support it. And various other people were sent to see the Shah. And he was very reluctant because he knew that Mossadegh was still popular and he didn't want to go against a popular figure. Mm-hmm. The Shah was a young man at this time, is, you know, in his early 30s. He was very weak, and he was very indecisive. And so it took literally about 3 weeks of constant pressure for the CIA to convince the Shah finally to back the overthrow. But eventually they did. As they were doing all this, of course, they were going forward with the destabilization campaign that I described before that involved even opening up new newspapers and flooding Iranian newspapers with CIA-authored propaganda articles meant to discredit Mossadegh. For example, one of them was a crude, sexually explicit cartoon showing Mossadegh having sex with Ayatollah Khashoggi, and this, of course, was meant to discredit Mossadegh, make it look like he was, an immoral person. They spread rumors that Mossadegh was Jewish in order to try to undermine him and crude things of that sort.
They put bombs in somebody's house, is that right?
They put bombs in mosques and various other things of that sort. All of this was an effort to create an atmosphere of instability and to, you know, make Iranians think that Mossadegh was losing control. So they went forward with those things, and this was quite a substantial effort, especially the propaganda side of it. And they also went forward with trying to bribe the members of parliament. Apparently, as a result of that, you know, it seems that Mossadegh found out that foreign forces were trying to subvert parliament, and so he suddenly shut parliament down at the beginning of August. And when he did so, he said, you know, foreign agents are working in parliament. You know, this is no longer an instrument of the Iranian people. We have to close it down and hold new elections. And so that, of course, then, you know, Mossadegh knew exactly what was happening. He knew that foreign powers were working to overthrow him, so he shut the parliament down. And, of course, that, rendered invalid the whole U.S. effort to try to get the parliament to have a vote of no confidence. So at that point, then, the CIA had to go with their contingency plan of a full-scale military coup. And so they did that. They initially chose, I believe it was the night of something like August 13th. And so all the plans were ready to go on August 13th, and nothing happened. And it seems that Zahedi and his team just decided to wait a day or two. And because of that delay, apparently members of the Communist Party who were in the armed forces found out about this plot and warned Mossadegh. And so that when the plot went forward 2 days later on the night of August 15th, Mossadegh knew it was happening. He had his loyal military units come out and seize key locations in Tehran, and he had other units arrest the people who were coming to serve him with a dismissal decree from the Shah. And so the initial coup attempt failed. It was just a dismal failure, apparently mainly because the Zahedi people had delayed the coup attempt and their organization had somehow been penetrated by the Iranian Communist Party. So at that point, the coup had failed. And, you know, Roosevelt in Tehran sent a cable back to Washington saying, the coup has failed, what should we do? So the CIA headquarters in Washington sent a cable back to them immediately and said, this is a total disaster. You have to evacuate Iran, get yourself and all the other key people out. But Roosevelt, being a brave man, decided not to give up. And so at that point, he and his CIA team, with a little bit of help from certain Iranians, took various steps to start up another coup attempt. They did a number of things. One of the most important things they did was to make copies. Of course, this was well before the times of photocopiers, but they had a copying machine, different technology, and made copies of the Shah's royal decree dismissing Mossadegh, and then distributed them all over Tehran and distributed them to the press. And this is very important because then, you know, it quickly came out to the Iranian people that the Shah had legally dismissed Mossadegh. And that was pretty important in dramatizing the situation and convincing people who, you know, many Iranians still were very in favor of the monarchy in those days, convincing people that, you know, Mossadegh had to go. They also created various, you know, demonstrations and instabilities in Tehran. They attacked mosques. They attacked party headquarters. They attacked pro-Mossadegh newspapers. CIA crowds tore down statues of the Shah and just created a lot of chaos in Tehran in the next couple of days. Some of this, at least, they were doing, pretending to be members of the Communist Party. The reason for doing this, of course, was to make Iranians feel that the Communist Party was trying to take over, and hopefully this would sway Iranians to come in favor of the coup.
Mark, I just want to... I don't want to interrupt you, but we are at the half of the hour, and I want to let people know that you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, and I'm speaking with Mark Gazirovsky, professor of political science at Louisiana State University and a scholar who had done lots of research on the CIA coup of 1953 in Iran. Let's play a very short piece of music, and then we'll come back and continue. Okay, welcome back. You're listening to The Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Gudar Zaktadari, your host, and I'm speaking with Professor Mark Gazirovsky, Professor of Political Science at Louisiana State University and a scholar, a researcher on Iranian history and especially on the 1953 coup in Iran. We were speaking about the coup and how it happened, and we are now close to the day of the coup. And just to mention that 3 days before that, the Shah of Iran left the country and traveled to Baghdad, apparently because he didn't want to be in Iran during the coup. Mark, you were talking about the events.
Well, so anyway, as I said, after the initial coup attempt failed, the CIA and its Iranian agents organized a series of demonstrations and problems in Tehran. Eventually, they decided that they would try another coup attempt on Wednesday, August 19th. And then they had to figure out how they would trigger this, and they just, you know, tried with all the connections they had. One thing they did was give about $10,000 to an intermediary to give to certain key clerical figures, most importantly Ayatollah Khashoggi. It's not clear whether the Ayatollah got that money and whether he played a role in organizing the crowds, but the CIA at least, you know, tried to use him. And they went to other people. Almost certainly they gave money to Ayatollah Behbahani, who was another populist clerical figure who was against Mossadegh. And they had also other people who could organize crowds in South Tehran. You know, it was easy to hire crowds in those days. And so through these various means, they organized a big crowd on the morning of August 19th that marched out of South Tehran and, you know, marched up into the city. The crowd grew in size as onlookers joined it. Military officers who were part of the initial coup plot that had failed 3 days earlier then joined the crowd. Other military units joined. They began to take over various locations. General Zahedi was hiding in the basement of one of the CIA officers' houses. So these military units eventually came and got him, and he was involved. Some of the military units went to Mossadegh's house and had a big tank battle with loyalist forces and defeated them, and Mossadegh narrowly escaped. And eventually these crowds took over the whole city, and by the end of the day, the coup had succeeded. They took over the radio station, military headquarters, various other key locations, and succeeded in overthrowing Mossadegh. It's important to point out that there was really very little popular activity in the street on behalf of Mossadegh in this period. There weren't any large crowds that came out and fought against these anti-Mossadegh crowds. For whatever reason, there wasn't any kind of upsurge of pro-Mossadegh sentiment that might have stopped the coup. It's not that Mossadegh was unpopular, but he didn't really have an active base in the street that was capable of organizing crowds. And so he was really quite weak by this time. It was pretty easy to overthrow him. If I might just add, I think it would be appropriate to say a few things about what this meant for Iran and where it took Iran in the following years. Is that okay?
Yeah, but let me announce that people want to call in and ask questions, our phone number is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and you're welcome to call and ask question. And Mark, please go ahead.
Just the last thing I want to say about this is that, you know, first of all, there should be no mistake that the CIA, the United States government, was directly responsible for the overthrow of Mossadegh. As I said before, Mossadegh, you know, acted in ways that contributed to this, but, you know, that shouldn't take away from the fundamental point that it was the CIA that did this. But that being said, you know, another thing that's important to say about this from the point of view of how it affected Iranian politics is that this was really just the beginning of U.S. involvement in Iran. If the U.S. had just done the coup and then stopped, conditions in Iran might well have reverted back and a Mossadegh-like figure might well have taken over 5 or 10 years later. But this was just the beginning. After the coup occurred, the United States began this massive effort to rebuild Iran in a pro-Western way, in some ways pretty similar to what the U.S. is doing right now in Iraq. The U.S. pumped huge amounts of money into Iran to support the Shah's government, kept it afloat for several years until the oil money, you know, came back to high levels. The United States created the Shah's notorious secret police force, SAVAK, which later became infamous for tortures and things like that. The United States did a great deal in the following 10 years after the coup to strengthen the dictatorship that was initiated with the coup. So people shouldn't, you know, should keep the coup in perspective. It was a very important, very negative event for Iranian politics. But it wasn't just that. It was also what came in the following 10 years. Because, it, you know, after all, it wasn't just immediately after the coup that the Shah was a strong dictator. It took years for him to build the strong dictatorship that he had. It was not really until the early 1960s that that a really strong dictatorship had been established. And the U.S. also was very culpable in that and played a key role.
Yeah, as you mentioned, he was, at the beginning, he had a very weak personality, and but gradually, I guess, he built that kind of attitude that at the end he was considered the most dictator in that region as far as dealing with dissent goes. And he did not pursue any kind of democratization that would be expected from a westernized system. He got rid of any kind of dissent, any kind of political activism. There was no party. It was a one-party political system, and and that basically ended up with the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which I have repeatedly talked about in this show, that the reason was there was no other alternative for people to go to except for the religious establishment.
Yeah. Yes, but it took some time for him to get this way. I mean, for example, in the early 1960s, 1961, 1962, again, a popular movement started to reemerge, and it began to look like you might have a repeat of the Mossadegh era, this time, you know, rather different people, but it was going in the same direction. And the United States, went, for example, in early 1961, when the Kennedy administration first came into office, they were extremely worried about Iran. They were really afraid that Iran was about to blow up, as so many countries in the regions were, in the region were doing at that time. And they did various things to try to help out, to stabilize the situation. It was really not until about 1963 that the Shah really finally got a firm grip on power. And from then on until the Islamic Revolution, you had a really serious dictatorship in Iran.
We have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. See, I was wondering if your distinguished caller could help us understand why our Democratic Senator Ron Wyden is trying to support this march to war against Iran. I think that why he's joined up with some of the most right-wing people in Congress to do this. Thanks. I'll just take it off the air.
Yeah, I can't speak for Senator Wyden. I don't know why he's doing it, but virtually the entire U.S. Congress is behind this sort of thing. There have been a series of votes over, you know, the last 5, 10, 20 years that have been extremely anti-Iran, you know, extremely against the Islamic Republic. There was a vote 6 or 8 years ago, for example, spearheaded by Newt Gingrich, to provide something like $30 million for covert action against Iran. So what's happening now is just, you know, a continuation of things that the U.S. has been doing for at least the last decade. Why is the United States doing this? Part of the reason is that the U.S. Congress is extremely pro-Israel, and a high priority for Israel is to deflect attention from what it's doing in the occupied territories and try to, you know, blame much of this on Iran, and it's been doing this for a long time. Another reason is that there has just been a real hysteria in the United States since September 11th about, you know, radicalism in general, and there's just this kind of blindness, you know, sort of lumping all the Muslim countries together. We saw this with the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. You know, Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th. As bad as Saddam Hussein is, he really had nothing to do with that whatsoever. And now they're trying to sort of bring Iran into the same kind of hysteria. Now, I don't mean to defend the Islamic regime in Iran. There's a lot of negative things about it, in my opinion. But to try to solve the problem, you know, by trying to overthrow it, is just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And not to mention the fact that, you know, there's just nobody on the outside that the United States can work with. You know, if Senator Brownback and these other people think that the monarchists or the Mujahideen Khalq or somebody like that has enough popular support in Iran to overthrow the Islamic regime, they're just kidding themselves. So it's a misguided effort. The only good thing I'd say about it is it's not really going to have any big impact.
When was the last time you traveled to Iran, Mark?
I was in Iran about a year ago for 3 weeks, most recently.
Okay. Well, how did you see the country, and what is happening with the reform movement? And is there any hope that something will really develop from inside, that there is no need for external forces?
Well, I'm pretty pessimistic, I'd have to say. I've been going to Iran for about the last 10 years, about once a year. I've spent a lot of time there over the years now. And I watched the reform movement build, and then I've watched it as it's crumbled in the last few years. I'm not very optimistic. I think that, you know, they really missed a key opportunity in the first year or so when Khatami was first elected president. I think they should have acted much more forcefully then. And even as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, they still had a lot of opportunity to do things. In the last year or so, I think things have really moved very much against the reform movement. They've lost a lot of their popular support. This was demonstrated in the municipal elections of a few months ago when there was a much, much lower turnout. You know, this was clearly a protest. Iranians just decided not to vote in protest against Khatami's weakness. And the reform movement is very split and very, you know, fighting amongst themselves now. But I don't think that the prospects for success have been lost. I think that, you know, in the next 2 years, there are various opportunities that they could seize upon to act more forcefully. I don't think it's out of the question that they could organize a massive movement to bring a more progressive regime in Iran, but it's getting quite late for that. You know, they've already missed a lot of opportunities, and there's a lot of alienation now in Iran. Three key things that I would be looking for in the next 2 years are, first of all, there are some important pieces of legislation that have been passed by the parliament. One of them has been vetoed by the Guardian Council. The other one probably will be very soon. The reformists have said, at least some of them have said, that they will make a big fight over these pieces of legislation, either resigning in mass or staging a referendum to support this legislation. So that process could be a series of events that might kick off a massive movement to sweep the conservatives away. Secondly, next February or so, there will be elections for the parliament. This will be a really, really hard-fought battle. The conservatives will try very hard to regain control over the parliament. If the reformists are not very active and working very hard by then, they're likely to lose control over the parliament. So that might be another flashpoint and certainly another crucial time. And then finally, about 2 years from now, there will be presidential elections. President Khatami can't run again. They have term limits. And that will be a time when the conservatives, if they play their cards right, could really snuff out the reform movement. And I would anticipate that in the months leading up to that, there will be a great deal of tension and agitation, and there could well be a big explosion in Iran. So, you know, I think if nothing happens in the next 2 years, and if that presidential election goes on and the conservatives take it and also take the parliament, then I think the reform movement is finished, and what we have is Islamic dictatorship for as long as it can last. But between now and then, I think there's still a chance that the reformists can make something work.
We have another caller, and let's go and caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, I had a question about the excuse me, National Azeri movement in Iran.
The which and, movement?
The National Azeri movement.
Because just recently the UN recognized Dr. Ali Chehraghani's organization in Iran as a national political movement. I'd like to know if the speaker knows anything about that. Thank you.
What's the name of the movement? I didn't catch it.
I guess Mr. Ali Chehraghani, he's
Southern Azerbaijan National Movement.
He's an Azeri activist. And I guess last month they had a conference in Washington, D.C. that Mr. Chehraghani spoke to.
Yes.
I'm not really familiar with it. It's not really of any great significance. Iranian Azeris are quite loyal to Iran, as far as I know. There have been a lot of efforts by the country of Azerbaijan to stir up unrest among Iranian Azeris, and it hasn't really been very successful. I don't really think that that's going anywhere, frankly.
Okay, I guess we are getting close to end of our show, and I would like to thank you, Mark, for giving the opportunity, and I hope we can arrange for another interview and maybe talk more about the present issues in Iran. And I really wanted to ask you what you think would happen after this operation in Iraq, and what is the prospect for that. So maybe we can do it in another time.
Sure, it'd be my pleasure. Yeah,
I would appreciate. I really appreciate giving us this time. Thank you very much, Mark.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. And I guess I have a couple of announcements to make. Let's go right to that. Maybe we can listen to a little piece of music in the background as well. There is a concert this Saturday night in Portland. It's a Parisa concert, and this is a rare opportunity, in my opinion, because not very many groups from Iran get the visa to come to U.S. And then especially after 9/11, it's very difficult for them to get a visa to come. And this is a very interesting event, and I would recommend everyone to try to go there. It's at Reed College on Saturday, May 10th at 7 o'clock at Elliott Hall Chapel at Reed College. For information, you can call 503-998-6816, 503-998-6816. And this is a program sponsored by Andy Shea Center in Portland, Oregon. There's also another movie coming up at the Film Center, Blackboard, by Samira Makhmalbaf. Is an Iranian filmmaker, very young, and she's actually daughter of Mohsen Makhmalbaf, who's a very well-known filmmaker. This is showing on May 27th until June 2nd, every night, 7 and 9 p.m. at Guild Theater. So Blackboard, May 27th to June 2nd. As I mentioned during the show, there are some documents about the 1953 coup in Iran that you can access those on my website at www.voicesofthemiddleeast.com. Voices of the Middle East is one word. And hopefully you'll enjoy the show tonight. And I had another interview about actually the coup d'etat in Iraq, which happened right after the Iranian coup in 1958 and 1963, but unfortunately we didn't have time tonight to play it. So with that, I would wish everyone a very happy ending and a good weekend.